Colleagues, welcome back to the office and welcome to our podcast for today. My name is Steve Yass, and this is Case Studies in Fraud and Technology Controls Part 2. We're continuing our discussion that we started in the first episode where we're looking at fraud in America today and around the world to try to understand what the heck is going on. Unfortunately, fraud has just proven to be very pervasive, widespread, and affecting all different types of organizations, big and small alike. In this series, we've started looking at the most recent edition of Fraud in America Today's report from the Institute of Certified Fraud Examiners, trying to understand essentially some of the commonalities of where and when fraud can occur. So hopefully we can prevent it from happening inside of our organizations. Where we pick up the conversation today is continuing through that study. We're going to start with taking a look at, for example, of collusion. You know, when collusion occurs, what type of people are those folks? And then what can we do to prevent it from happening? Well, here's a hint. Segregation of duties is a really good way to prevent that from occurring. We'll continue looking through here, looking at some of the differences between big businesses and small businesses. We're going to talk about how fraud is detected and what you could do to help promote the detection of fraud inside of your organization. And we'll also take a look then and start our discussion with some specific case studies in fraud. There's been a number of really interesting, high-profile instances of fraud that have occurred in the last couple of years that really we can glean a lot of insight and intelligence from. For example, looking at Elizabeth Mulder's case for her scam, which took over multiple years, stealing from friends and family, to the case of Rodolfo Olivius out of West Melbourne, Florida, stealing from his employer and more. You know, in looking at those, and we'll have more to look at in future editions of this series as well, we can glean some insight to what the heck is going on and hopefully, again, get some tips on how we can prevent that from happening to us. All this and more in today's episode of CPE Today. Now, before we get going, I do want to remind you that our podcast is available for CPE credit. If you happen to be a CPA or financial professional somewhere here in the beautiful United States or elsewhere in the world, you probably need continuing education credits to keep your license. Well, listening to our podcast, whether you're watching live or listening on the podcast platform of your choosing, you can get credits for watching or listening. Super simple. Head on over to cpetoday.com. You'll take a short 5-question quiz and you will earn a credit for today's class. If you're looking for today's class, the course code is CSF2. Again, today's course code is CSF2. So besides our podcast, we've got lots of other great materials, which we know you'll love to help you stay on top of your game. Today's presentation was presented at a recent State Society conference. And when we join you towards the end, we'll come back with a couple of review questions to reinforce the learning that we discussed for today. Enjoy our presentation. So the next question that we might want to ask ourselves: what about collusion? You know, how often are these going to be one person versus multiple people? Well, it's kind of straight down the middle here. You know, if we look at frauds occurring, about half the time they are individuals and about half the time they are groups of people. Now, in almost all circumstances, the amount of fraud loss goes up with the number of perpetrators included. So if you happen to have, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 people, the more people involved, the amount of money lost or compromised will certainly go up. You know why? Because, you know, you got to pay for these additional folks to be involved here. So collusion by design is just when you have two people working together on something, you know, and by design, collusion is very, very, very difficult to be able to, very, very difficult to be able to detect. And if you got two people, in almost all circumstances, you can circumvent internal controls, especially if there are two different organizations, or especially if they're at two different levels of the company. You know, if I'm, for example, the controller and I'm colluding with the bank, ooh, man, I mean, there's, I don't know how you'd possibly be able to get around that. You know, or if I am, let's say, the purchasing manager and I am colluding with the vendor of some sort, again, I don't know how you'd be able to circumvent that. That could be very hard to be able to detect and very hard to be able to prevent happening as well. And there's all different types of, you know, fraud, whether it be, you know, for example, kickback schemes or direct financial compensation for services, or not even something as simple as maybe trying to get the best rate for a company and for our client. So there was actually a recent, really good recent example of this. There's a company called Utz Quality Food, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with Utz. You know, they make delicious, delicious carbohydrates of my favorite type, pretzels. And Utz, unfortunately, recently had a fraud occur with them where they had almost $1.5 million stolen through a kickback scheme. Okay. And this involves somebody inside the Utz purchasing department and a vendor, and if you know, that was essentially colluding with this person. They issued Utz falsely issued 40 fake purchase orders for stuff they never actually received. These went to a vendor who never actually delivered the good, and they were able to kind of play both companies, you know, against each other, and ultimately received about $1.5 million of fraudulent funds. So, you know, if this company had better internal controls, they might have been able to prevent something like that from happening. Let me show you and give you an example how of some of this might occur. Let's take a look at, for example, our audit trail functionality inside of QuickBooks Online, just as a simple example here. So I'm running the QuickBooks test drive file, which is Craig's Design and Landscaping Services. If you just Google QBO test drive, you can try this out for yourself. And I just want to point out audit trails, where they might live and generally what they might look like. Okay. Now, if we switch over here down to our reports view, okay, and if we just search for this report over here, we will see that there is this audit log, as they call it here in QuickBooks. And this audit log is a log of all transactions that have occurred inside of this account. Now, one of the cool things about these SaaS-based solutions is there is zero opportunity for anybody, for that matter, to be able to adjust how this file operates or how QuickBooks operates. Intuit controls all aspects of the user experience here, including logging all systems actions. So if I, for example, come in and I log into the system, you're going to see those actions occur here. And if I change anything, we would see those actions occur as well. Now, one of the most common things that people will do is they will change checks. Again, we tend to put a little bit too much emphasis on accounts receivable when really I think the emphasis should be on accounts payable. One of the most common things that they will do is that they will write a check to themselves, and then they will change the name of the check after they've cashed that check. So as an example here, let's go ahead and create a vendor. Let's call it Steve Co. Industries. Okay. And we're going to go ahead and save this as a vendor here. Okay, and we're going to write a check. And what they will typically do is they will look at the chart and they will find something that's pretty easy to be able to dump some money in, and that expense would go relatively unnoticed. And so for a lot of organizations, that would be cost of goods sold, or it could be my personal favorite, supplies. Okay, so you know what? I've worked here. I've been the controller for Craig's Landscaping Service for a long time. And you know what? Craig has overlooked me for my promotion consistently since I started here. You know, I should be chief landscaper now. And you know what? I've taken over his accounting system and as part of my duties, and I'm going to give myself a nice bonus of $1,500. And we'll go ahead and save and close this. Let's go ahead and actually give the check date of the 31st. And we're going to go ahead and select save and close. Okay. So I would then print that check. I would then go take that check to my bank. I would cash that check. And it's important to note, increasingly, even though things and services like online banking are becoming even more ubiquitous and even more widespread and available, less and less are we actually looking at the actual checks themselves. Very less and less are we actually examining the actual checks to see what they say and who they are written out to. You know, in the old days, we used to get an envelope full of canceled checks at the end of the period. And frankly, that just doesn't happen anymore. Okay. So with respect to this, we don't actually look and see where these checks are. You know, we don't actually see what these checks are coming back as. Likewise, we don't actually look at the EFTs nearly as much. They can be very ambiguous when we look at an ACH transaction. And on that ACH transaction, you know, it can be pretty ambiguous of what it is. It could say something like service fees, or, you know, rarely does it actually tell us exactly what somebody did. Well, what they would end up doing is they would come over here after the fact that they have written that check. they cash that thing. And then in order to not be discovered, they would go and change the name and probably delete the vendor as associated with it as well. So here, we'll come over here. We've already printed our check. And instead of this being Steveco Industries, let's just pick something else. Let's pick Lumber Building Supplies. And we're going to go ahead and select Save and Close. Okay. And then now if we were to go print that check again, or if we were to go look at that check again, it wouldn't say my name, but rather it would say Norton Lumber Supplies, indicating that that is who that check is from. And unless I physically had that check in my possession, it'd be really kind of hard for me to see, because all the numbers, the amounts, and everything else are going to match. And so if we go and we look at our audit trail report, and this may or may not work because this is a sample file here, but hopefully it does. Let's see our audit log. Okay, and in fact, we do see this. And so what we can see here in our audit log is that we can actually see that certain things happen on certain dates and times. So we can see here on June 10th, okay, the user logged in was Craig Carlson. He created a vendor called Steveco Industries. He created check number 71 for $1,500. Okay. And as we kind of look through over here, we'll actually see that Craig Carlson edited that check and changed it to a different person. If we click on the history of this, we can actually see the nature of this transaction, and we can compare this line by line. And we can see that, you know, went from the printed stage to the editing stage. And if we look at this, we will actually see that the name of this check changed from one to the other. Likewise, if we click into the actual check itself and we click down here to more, we can see this transaction journal as well as the audit history of this particular transaction. We can see, and that's a quick way of being able to get access to this info. And so this is the great way of being able to track. This data cannot be adjusted, cannot be modified, cannot be otherwise changed to anything else. Okay. So once this information is committed to QuickBooks, it's there forever. Okay. Likewise, if we come over here and we delete this vendor, let's go try deleting that real quick. Okay. We'll come over here to Steveco Industries, and we're going to go ahead and delete this terrible vendor. Okay. Let's see. Batch actions. Let's see. Go back one, actually. Come on. There we go. I think I need to scroll down here. Here's Steveco. Okay. And we're going to come over here and we're going to go ahead. Oh, wait a minute. You can't delete things in QuickBooks Online and many of these other accounting solutions, Dynamics, Acumatica, many others. It's perpetual. You can make something inactive, but you can't delete it. Once something is created inside of one of these solutions, it's there forever. You know, and if we choose, for example, to make this client inactive or this vendor inactive, okay, it's still there. Okay, if we come over here to the right-hand side, okay, you'll see that there's this option that says include inactive. And the takeaway from this is that nothing in most accounting solutions ever is actually deleted. It's only what we call logically removed, where it's just not currently in that display. So by design, these cloud applications are so much more secure and better secure from an internal controls perspective than what we would ever get with on-premise technology, because we don't have access to modify anything with respect to QuickBooks. Now, there's one other thing I want to show you with respect to any accounting solution. It doesn't matter what we end up going with here, but rather a feature that is in any qualified accounting solution, which is the closing date. Okay, so if we come up here to accounts and settings, and then we come down to our accounting settings on the left-hand side here, which are in our advanced menu tab. There we go. Under our accounting settings here, what I want to draw your attention to is this option right here that says close the books. Okay. Right now it's set to off. One of the things I hate about QuickBooks the most, and it doesn't matter if you're running QuickBooks Enterprise or QuickBooks Desktop or QuickBooks Online, is they don't follow accounting periods. It's everything is transactional date-based. So you could post anything you want into whatever period you want. Well, one of the best things you could possibly do to help reduce risk and exposure is to close your books on a regular basis. Go ahead and slide that little option right here. Turn that guy on. Give yourself a closing date, let's say of June 1st. Or May 31st, whatever you'd like. Okay. And then you have a couple of options. You can, for example, allow changes, but give that person a warning. It's like a nice slap on the wrist, does nothing for you. Or what I would recommend, allow changes after a warning and entering a password. And this is different than the password for the actual file itself. This would be something, for example, that the controller, CFO, CEO would do. Now, granted, if they're the ones committing the fraud, it doesn't really help you, but this would help, for example, against normal staff. But this little small thing right here, it's one of the absolute best things you could possibly do to reduce your overall risk and exposure. So, as much as you can, I'd recommend that you close your books on a fairly regular process. Okay. Now, folks, I just want to point out, I actually did make one quick oversight. Our break is at 2:30. Yeah, 2:30 Central, 3:30 Central, not 2 or 12, just as a reminder for that. So we're going to take our break in about half hour or so, about roughly halfway through. I just kind of get confused on the time zones as we're operating in several time zones at the moment. So hopefully that won't be a problem for you. I'm leaving the polling questions up as long as I possibly can. If you need to step away for a few minutes, by all means, make yourselves comfortable. Here is your next polling question. Now, one of the best things that we could do from a, let's just say, management perspective is hiring good people and then not putting all of our responsibilities in that one person. And what I mean by this is segregation of duties. We have a variety of duties that, whenever possible, should be segmented into separate people. Okay. So there are a couple of different categories that ideally should not be done by a single person. And if you're a large enough company, they should not be done by a single team, but rather distributed across a group of people or across a group of teams. And a lot of our risk of collusion can be reduced a lot, I'm not going to say eliminated, but could be reduced a lot by separating these duties into separate functions. So changing and having different people do different things is also a really good way of reducing our risk, kind of, you know, changing it up from every time. But we want these duties separated into different people. Okay. The person who's authorizing something should not be the same person who's recording it. You know, the person recording, this is the person preparing the source documents or putting together the reports that management's going to see. The person who is responsible for the custody of that asset, directly or indirectly, you know, if it's the person who writes the checks, well, it shouldn't be the same person who authorizes the checks or reports upon the checks. The person receiving checks in the mail should be a different person than the person who's putting that data into the system. Okay. Now, no matter what, if you had to pick out one thing to be separated from the other three, it'd be reconciliation. You know, whenever possible, that should be done by somebody outside of the organization or the outside of the organizational team that's responsible for whatever duty is being done. In terms of the impact of this, well, you know, the more people involved, the higher the losses. One person, not so much you can do. Your average loss here is about $75,000. The more people involved, the more money is lost. At two people, it's $150,000, three or more, we start getting into some real money. Okay. So we all need to be involved with reducing our risk and exposure with respect to collusion. And I personally think the absolute best thing that you could possibly do is creating a good company culture and investing in good quality people. You know, I'm not going to say somebody who is a, I'm not going to say you're never going to find somebody who wouldn't do this, but if you create good, positive company culture, that'll usually do a pretty good job of help reducing your overall risk. Looking at the people who are committing this fraud, an overwhelming percentage of them, almost 90% of them, have never been charged or even charged or convicted with any sort of other crime related to whatever their fraud was. You know, there might be the, you know, the occasional DUI or something like that, or a drug possession charge earlier in their life. But if we look at people who've committed fraud, they're almost always first-time offenders in terms of getting caught. Very rarely are these people, you know, let's say seasoned pros. So what I will tell you at the same time, only about 75% of financial crimes are actually prosecuted. You know, about a quarter of those crimes never even get reported. They're handled privately, off the books, and, you know, the company just chooses to not report it, as, you know, that could present other issues. You know, imagine facing regulatory issues. You know, as an example here, Sarbanes-Oxley, FINRA, other types of compliance frameworks might require you to report that. Well, that could also cause issues, for example, like the stock price taking a hit. Well, the company might not choose to report it. Now, what this also tells us is that people don't just commit fraud because they wake up and do it. They do it because they have to. You know, these vast majority of these people are normal people. You know, they're people living their lives that had something happen or occur in their life, and they grew into this. You know, what I would say, it's important you know what's going on in the lives of your staff. You know, and I'm not going to say if somebody's going through a life issue, they're going to commit fraud, but it does present the additional risk that we should at least acknowledge. Consider, for example, people who are going through a nasty divorce and having their, you know, their financial life split in two. People who are under significant financial strain through some sort of externality, substance abuse, gambling addiction. In today's environment, certainly the impact of COVID has caused other people to face issues that they've never faced before. And you know, they could be underemployed where they have no choice. It could also be something as been, you know, horrible as somebody sick in the family and they need money to be able to pay for that operation, the surgery, the drugs. It's incredible with what, you know, medical costs can be here in America today. So most people will never commit fraud, but there is a greater chance in these different categories. What I will say is they grow into it. Every time becomes a little bit easier. They come up with a story in their head. I'm borrowing money. I'm owed the money. I'm taking a loan, whatever. You know, again, good company culture, get involved with people's lives. Let me go ahead and throw out a question to the group and feel free to leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. Would you ever hire somebody in your organization that was convicted of a fraud? You know, would you ever hire somebody that, you know, for example, committed fraud, misappropriation, and then put them in your organization? You know, I could tell you from my perspective, I believe in second chances, but at the same time, I mean, you know, whenever you hire somebody like that, you are putting yourself at risk, you know, in terms of your reputation and your exposure. And, you know, if you knowingly hire somebody who has had this happen, it could, for example, come back to bite you in the future. What I would tell you is you always do a criminal background check. All criminal information is always public. You should definitely check with your local laws regarding employment and HR. I'm sure they can tell you exactly what you can and can't do. But with respect to criminal history, it's always public, with the exception of minors. You might want to consider a credit check too. I mean, I'm not going to say somebody's credit history is a reflection of how good of an employee they will be, but it does give you a sense of, you know, what kind of house they keep. You know, and at the very minimum, do a Google check. I mean, Google is one of the absolute best ways of discovering anything about anybody. And they might have had records expunged, but you know what? The internet never forgets. Laws vary widely. What's legal here in California might not be legal at your in your state. You know, we have the difference between right to work and at will, which does present some differences with respect to how we manage this process. But I would tell you that you should consider at least doing a criminal background check. And looking at the comments that people have left here, almost resoundingly, the answer is no, they would not hire somebody who is convicted of a prior fraud offense. Now, I would say maybe you put them in an operations perspective, maybe in a maintenance perspective, something like that. But there's so many great people in the world, I don't think you need to go out on a limb. Now, if we look at types of fraud committed and the frequency of this, a vast majority of fraud is asset misappropriation. That's everything from stealing money to stealing inventory and everything in between. However, there's literally only so much you can walk out the door with. I mean, there's only so much you can physically carry in your arms. So, you know, people stealing pens or post-it notes, that's really not my priority. Cash certainly is always going to present an issue. But again, there's not really much beyond the scope of physical assets that somebody's going to carry that people aren't going to notice. If we look at the high end of this, it only occurs about 10% of the time. It's fraudulent statements and fraudulent information. However, look at the dollar value loss of this, almost $1 million, $800K. And I'm sure it will only go up in future as the value of information exceeds. Well, who is this? This is our executives. These are our owners. These are people who get paid off of profit. Okay. People who get paid off of profit have an interest in changing the nature of the financial statements for stock options or to pump up the price of the shares and sell them off. People who get paid by hour, they steal money. They steal assets. Now, right here in the middle, these are your managers. Okay. These are your kickback schemes. These are your preferential buying, you know, hiring somebody who's a family member, working with a vendor that's not giving you the best possible rate. That's going to come from your mid-tier people. So asset misappropriation, least expensive. Theft of information, most expensive. Let me go ahead and ask the group here. Feel free to leave me a comment. What do you think is the most expensive thing in your organization and the most detrimental if it were stolen? What do you think it is? Okay. I'd love to know what you're thinking. Now, on my part, I think the most expensive thing any company ever has is information. You know, your customer list, your unique competitive advantages, your intellectual property. You can't make that stuff back up. Information is always the most expensive. You know, if you've got a really competitive advantage on something and that person who knows it leaves and goes to a competitor, they're not only stealing you from you today, they're stealing from you tomorrow and every other year in the future. I've heard it time and time again with people leaving and starting their own businesses, which there's really not much you can do there. Yes, you can do things like covenants not to compete, but you know, at some point it might not become useful or helpful. I more worry about people leaving and going to competitors. That's the thing that I would be most concerned about. Let's look at the relative risk of asset misappropriation. Now, we again always tend to put a lot of focus on stealing cash, and cash does help, you know, or it can hurt you. It's about 15% of occurrences. But again, there's only so much cash you can steal before people will notice. Okay. A vast majority of this comes through accounts payable. You know, it could be, for example, check tampering. It could be billing. It could be skimming. It could be any number of things. And if we look at the dollar value lost here, it is much higher. You know, I would tell you certainly put controls on AR. AR is a pretty easy thing to be able to put in a good control environment. You could do a lockbox scheme as an example, you know, where your checks for your payables are sent directly to the bank, you know, and I'm not going to say you eliminate your risk, but you've essentially shifted your risk to the bank. It's a great way of reducing your risk and exposure. Another way that you could reduce your risk and exposure for billing is to utilize billing services like bill.com, where everything has to be paid electronically with multiple people reviewing it. Or you could use a sweep account or a zero balance account where they only check cash the checks that are presented. You know, and as long as you don't have a fox in the hen house, you should be okay with respect to using one of those services. Now, whether you're a big business, whether you're a small business, there are different, risks no matter what, but the risks are a little bit different. Big businesses, you know, their biggest risk is corruption. You know, they're so large that sometimes they're not able to determine what occurred and how it occurred inside the organization. Okay, if we're a smaller business, it's going to be our billing. It's going to be our accounts payable side of this that I would be worried about. Likewise, if we come down here, people overstating their expense reimbursements and submitting fraudulent receipts for things. So depending on the nature of your business, it would be something to consider. Now, what I will say, I think it hurts small business a lot more. I mean, think about an Apple. I mean, do you think Tim Cook really cares if, you know, somebody goes out to lunch on a person, you know, takes a long lunch period and maybe takes a family member and, you know, steals $100, you know, for a nice lunch at Morton's or something? Probably not. I mean, it's not material, but if you're a small business, you know, that could be a lot of money, you know, depending on what occurs here. Big businesses can absorb the losses. They also are large enough to have a lot of the control environment necessary to prevent that from even occurring. Okay, small businesses, not the same case. Now, if we look how fraud is actually detected, it's incredible. It really kind of shows you that controls, for the most part, don't really get you that far. You know, if we look at how fraud is actually discovered and reported, a vast majority of it occurs outside of the company. Okay. A majority of it, almost 40%, comes from tips. Okay. That comes from people like employees and customers and vendors and competitors, you know, reporting that it occurs, you know, but it doesn't come from our controlled environment. It doesn't come from, you know, the audit log and closing the books and user records and accounts and things of this nature. It just comes from somebody out of the kindness of their heart saying, hey, I think you should know about this. Other major factors that we did cover this: internal audit, management review. You know, certainly these can be a helpful and effective at 15% and 30%. But I just want to point out, if we look at outside of the company, if we consider, for example, tips at 40%, if we look at by accident, 7%, if we look at external auditing, if we look at, for example, notification by police and confession, about half will come from outside the control environment. One of the most effective things you could possibly do is give people the opportunity to let you know when there's a problem. Okay, if we look, tips are a fabulous way of being able to uncover issues inside of our company, with a vast majority of the tips coming from people inside the company themselves, your employees, or it might be your vendors or even your customers. They're people that know the organization. If you give them the opportunity to do something honest, to report it, they probably will do so. Okay, but if they're not given the opportunity, well, you know, I don't know. I mean, very rarely are people going to walk up to you and say, hey, this is what happened. You know, I think if they're given, for example, the opportunity to report it anonymously through a phone tip service, an email, something, I think you have a much higher likelihood of getting it reported. And there's no reason not to have a tip line or a tip email. I mean, it doesn't cost you anything to have an email or even really a phone number these days. So why not have it? So, what I will tell you, we got some good news. Another report by the ACFE, so this was their anti-fraud technology benchmarking report, does show us that more organizations are willing to invest in technology to help prevent and detect fraud. 55% of the respondents said that they will be looking for ways to increase their budget for anti-fraud technology over the next couple of years. They said they were going to use services such as artificial intelligence to be able to detect fraud. We expect those budgets to be able to improve and expand. Presently, 2/3 of respondents are using some sort of exception reporting and half are using automated monitoring to determine, you know, when fraud might occur. So there are some things that are changing, you know, but it's not maybe happening as fast as we would like it to be. So what can we conclude from our conversation thus far? Well, first, businesses of all sizes have recognized the problem. A lot of us are using technology and building good company culture and hiring good people as ways of being able to find a solution. Well, you should recognize that there is no single method or technology that is effective by itself, but rather a system of internal controls to be able to balance this across our companies. It's not just a one-trick pony. We need a whole circus in order to be able to contain this risk for our organizations. Effective controls will consist of people utilizing this technology in tandem with traditional measures. You know, can't go wrong with a good old-fashioned physical inventory check. You can't go wrong with a good old-fashioned surprise audit of receivables. You know, things like this, spontaneity, moving people around, asking questions, can be very effective with respect to helping to determine what our fraud losses could be, and then hopefully helping to reduce them. And then also at the same time, I mean, besides just reducing risk, you know, this is also really helpful for promoting organizational effectiveness and efficiency too. I mean, an efficiency audit could be really good at determining things that are working and not working inside your company. Okay, so let's move on to our next section here, which is going to be some case studies in fraud and talking about, you know, essentially ways by looking at other examples and other people and other companies, how fraud has occurred for them and what we can learn from this to hopefully prevent it from happening inside of our companies. So one of the things I thought I would lead off with is that fraud might not occur from the people, you know, you think it might occur from, you know, I always used to think, you know, that you'd be able to recognize, oh, that person right there, that's a fraudster, that's for sure. You know, maybe they'd show up, for example, to our office, you know, wearing the striped shirt, you know, that you would see from like the 1900s, you know, for the prisoner gang or something like that. The reality is fraud can kind of occur from people you would not necessarily think. According to the as an example of this, according to the FBI, since 1990, the number of male embezzlers have increased by 4%. However, at the same time, the number of female embezzlers has increased by 40%. The ACFE said that, you know, some of this is reflective also in the dollar amounts that people have stolen as well. When men are involved, the median loss is $156,000, whereas when women are involved, the median loss is only $89,000. There's actually a pretty cool website, pinkcollarcrime.com, that you can learn with respect to how women have been involved in various white-collar crime and embezzlement schemes over the years. And from this website, you can look at a lot of different studies that will show that women are actually involved in more embezzlements than men, although in these particular cases, it's usually less money involved. So I've got we're going to look at probably three or four big cases of fraud that have occurred and hopefully, again, try to determine some of the things that might have occurred and how we can prevent this from happening inside of our organizations. The first one that we're going to take a look at here is the case of Elizabeth Mulder, and this occurred in my backyard of Southern California. So on May 15th, 2017, Elizabeth Mulder pled guilty to stealing over $1.5 million during a seven-year scam. Mulder faces up to 23 years in prison and was sentenced only 5 years after pleading guilty to a felony wire fraud as well as for filing fake tax returns. She also agreed to pay client restitution of that amount. What's crazy about this is that she stole the money from her family and friends, which always just kind of gets me. I just cannot imagine ever violating that responsibility and relationship with loved ones, with anybody for that matter, but you know, even my family, I cannot imagine doing that. Well, Miss Mulder here, she passed herself off as a qualified accountant, even though she had absolutely no formal training, and she solicited friends and acquaintances as her clients, and she ran kind of a little mini accounting, business services, bookkeeping firm. And she would handle, you know, everything from simple bookkeeping to filing their tax returns. And I believe even some payroll services from time to time as well. So once she gained the trust of her clients, she began to divert the tax payments to her own bank account. And the way she did this is that she made checks payable to literally income tax payments. Okay. Most banks will cash any check that you give them, you know, as long as you've got the necessary paperwork to do so. Well, here in the great state of California, I'm not sure if she filed an incorporation for that name or she maybe just filed a DBA. Well, she was able to start some sort of entity with the legal name of Income Tax Payments. She then went to her bank account, showed them the necessary paperwork, and was able to cash checks written out to income tax payments. I mean, what the heck were people thinking for allowing that to occur? So clients would write a check thinking they're writing a check to the Franchise Tax Board or the EDD or the IRS, and she would just take that check and cash it, you know? And once she had her client's money, she used it for whatever she wanted, you know, vacations, jewelry, horse rental. She even bought them gifts with her own money. How nice of her, right? So if you'd like, there's a really good YouTube video that's included with the materials. If you'd like to kind of read a little bit and hear a little bit and watch a little bit more about her case. But let's talk about some of the crimes that Ms. Mulder was charged with. Well, she was charged with diverting 77 checks made out for tax payments from a hair salon run by two of her friends. They thought they were paying payroll and their taxes. In fact, they were paying Ms. Mulder. She was charged with drafting 44 checks from a travel agency that she wrote checks out of to pay their bills and to pay their tax payments to her company, Income Tax Payments. She was charged with stealing for more than $200,000 from a Pilates studio, and she even took out loans in the name of the business and signed on behalf of the business as well. She pocketed over $200,000 from a San Clemente wine distributor, and thefts from a copy and print company that ended up going out of business after being in business for 22 years because of all the losses and penalties that had occurred because of Ms. Mulder's crimes. So what's interesting with this is that, I mean, all the present elements of fraud are there. I mean, she had some sort of need. I guess maybe it's to live a life that she wasn't earning herself. She had opportunity in the event of writing checks for her clients. She had the rationalization of whatever way she came up in her head to make herself feel better about what she was doing. Again, I find that to be quite shameful, but unfortunately that's still quite common amongst these people. And there's a lot of commonalities that would occur between her and many of the other frauds that we see in the news. Now, as a kind of a postscript to this, what's really kind of horrifying is that all those clients actually still owed the taxes, you know, that she had been stealing. In this particular case for that print and tax shop, or the print shop that ended up going out of business, the owner is still dealing with the payments for the tax agencies. I mean, the tax agencies are like, well, you know, you should have known better. And in a lot of instances, they're probably right. But the fact that they got defrauded doesn't change the fact that these companies still owe the taxes to the agencies that they were working with. And so the Franchise Tax Board, the EDD, the IRS is still going after many of these clients to get them to pay. So unfortunately, with Ms. Mulder, she gets, you know, I'm sure a nice stay in Club Fed, but the havoc and chaos that she's caused these people will not be going away anytime soon. So my takeaway from this, and one of the things I always recommend people to do, is to check the license of whoever that they are working with. You know, I make it an active effort to check the professional license of any person that I am working with inside of my organization. And I want to ensure that not only are you, say, who you are, you know, that the addresses match, you know, if it's a contractor, for example, they have all the necessary insurance and permits and bonds that are in place. Because you never know. I mean, there's so many people in the world today that it's pretty easy to be able to commit identity theft and portray yourself as somebody else. Now, I'd like to think I wouldn't have to do this, for example, for, you know, a good buddy or you know, a client that I've known for a long time, but, you never know, you know, and it's always kind of worth checking in on yourself or checking in on, the people that you're doing business with. Let me give you a quick example of this. I'm going to switch over here to the Department of Consumer Affairs in the great state of California. Okay. And in California, as in many states, you can look up this information as easy as just doing a Google search. And here in the state of California, you need a license to do just about anything here. And we have several different boards and groups and licensing bureaus for just about everything, from veterinarians to structural pest control, to pharmacy, to whatever. And for other professions like medical, you can certainly look up the California Medical Examiner. And for legal, you could look it up with the Attorney General in the Department of Justice. Well, here, we come on over here to the Board of Accountancy. I can go ahead and put in a name. Okay. And you can go ahead and check the license of somebody. You know, so over here, here's my license, 109744, something I'm very proud of. And we can see, in fact, here that I am licensed. My license is clear. You can see when and where I was issued, as well as when my next expiration will be. And I think it's always useful to be able to check the license of whomever you are working with. They should be very forthright with that information, too. You know, this is a great way of ensuring that whoever you're working with is, in fact, the correct person and not, in fact, someone portraying themselves as somebody who they are not. So I'd love to know. Leave me a comment. What do you think you would have done, or what do you think her clients could have done to prevent or detect this? You know, in my mind, it's check the license. You know, granted, if she's not a CPA or an enrolled agent or some sort of license, you wouldn't know that, but maybe you'd have at least have a conversation or at least know that you're not working with a licensed professional. Leave me a comment. Let me know what you think that you could have done to prevent this from occurring. So in our next case, we are going to go ahead and take a look at the case of Rodolfo Olivas. Now, in the Rodolfo Olivas case, he was a resident of Melbourne, West Melbourne, Florida, and he stole over $1.3 million from the government, I believe the city of... In this particular one, Mr. Rodolfo ended up stealing from his employer, Hill Inc. Okay. Now, Rodolfo here, he ended up using fraudulent credit card transactions as well as writing company checks for his personal expenditures. Okay. Mr. Rodolfo here ended up racking up over $1 million in fraudulent charges on an unauthorized American Express account for his employer and wrote approximately $291,000 in fraudulent checks. Okay. Now the transactions in question here go back all the way to 2010. And although we don't actually have perfect records for this because Rodolfo here started in 2001. So why would it have started 10 years later? I'm sure there might have been circumstances that would have allowed him to maybe take money even earlier than that, but maybe we just don't have the records. And that's often the case. Often more will go on than what we can actually find records for. Okay, so Mr. Rodolfo here was, his fraud was discovered while he was on vacation and another team member was performing his duties. And according to police reports, he had used the money to lead a relatively lavish lifestyle. How nice of him. Well, he used the funds to pay for cruises, vacationing at Disney properties, buying season tickets to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and others. It's reported that he even took colleagues and coworkers to these games. You know, I guess nobody bothered to ask, like, hey, man, like, how are you paying for all this? You know? Detectives also reported that Mr. Rodolfo here had a history of substance abuse and that pretty much his life had been spiraling out of controls. Well, what had occurred? And how did this go down? Well, he was in charge of purchasing and payables for his company. In the words of the detective, he was the sole person that was over all of that stuff. He was able to input information into the work computer using false entries that showed him doing one thing, but it was actually checks written out to him. What did we take a look at earlier? If you can't delete things, people can't change them after the fact. So in this particular instance, in this company, there were very low internal controls. There were no segregations of duty, no oversight, no data analysis, ownership, management were not really paying attention to what was going on. It was said that the owner and the family trusted him like he was a family member. The police said that he did not make any, Mr. Rodolfo here did not make any significant purchases, but rather his addiction, you know, kind of spiraled out of control and, you know, he just kind of did what he needed to do. And just like with the other case, there's a really interesting video, if you get a second and you want to watch it, that I'm taking excerpts from that kind of really kind of talk about his case and what had occurred here. Sorry, I get it. Some of these a little bit confused. Unfortunately, there's so many instances of fraud coming out of the state of Florida that often you can kind of get it confused in your head. But in Mr. Olivas's case here and Mr. Rodolfo's case here, really, you know, I think it's a good example of creating an environment where this fraud could not only occur, but go on and prosper. I don't understand how a company could have an unauthorized credit card. I just don't get it. I mean, wouldn't the controller have gotten the receipts, the bill? I mean, who was paying it? I mean, wouldn't the ownership notice $100,000, $200,000 coming out of the business in a given period? That's not always the case. So the question I'll leave to the group here, what could have or should have Olivius's employer done to prevent or detect this? Go ahead, leave me a comment and let me know what you think. All right, colleagues, welcome back. Let's go ahead and wrap up with three quick review questions in the context of the materials that we just discussed today. Man, there's just so much with respect to fraud and identity theft and data breaches, and all this is kind of like so interrelated with each other. There's so much to learn. But let's go ahead and discuss some review questions on today's specific topics. All right, our first review question. Which of the following statements is generally true about collusion and fraud? Is it collusion is not a material factor when considering fraud? No way. You know, collusion definitely can be material, and it could definitely get pretty large depending on the number of perpetrators. Frauds with two perpetrators are more costly than frauds with three perpetrators? Nope, that's not correct. The more perpetrators we see, the higher the dollar value lost. And likewise, frauds with one perpetrator are more costly than frauds with three perpetrators. Nope. The more people involved, the higher the cost. So our correct answer here is frauds involving collusion are generally more costly than single perpetrator frauds. More people involved, got to make it worth it. You've got to have the money to justify the fraud, and so they end up stealing more. Our next question. According to the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, which of the following accounts for the most fraud detections? Okay, is it IT controls? I'd like to think so, considering I primarily work in technology, but sadly, it's not that, although it certainly can contribute. Is it external audits? Nope, not going to be there. Unfortunately, with collusion and fraud by its design can be very difficult to detect, and so it's only going to capture a very narrow band of fraud that is being perpetrated. Okay, is it surveillance and monitoring? That could certainly help, but that's not the best method. The best method, believe it or not, is going to be tips. So I would strongly recommend that you have a tip hotline, tip email, something that you could allow for your staff, the public, whomever, to be able to submit information if they happen to see fraud occurring. All right, a third review question. How much has embezzlement increased by gender since 1990, according to the FBI? So this kind of goes to back to the phenomenon that we're seeing with increased women being involved in perpetrating fraud. And is it going up by 8%, by female for 4%? Is it male going up by 4% and female going up by 8%? Or is it something else? Well, the correct answer here is male embezzlement has increased slightly by 4%. Female embezzlement, however, has gone up pretty dramatically since the 90s, up to 40%. So that brings us to the end of our class today. So today we discussed and continued our review on fraud in America today, looking at the examination of the reports. We've also started to go into some of the examples of fraud using some compelling news stories that have occurred in the last couple of years. And so we talked about how we can use different types of controls and different types of checks and balances to help reduce fraud to a more acceptable risk level in our organization. In the next episode, we're going to continue this discussion looking at some different examples of fraud in America today, looking at a few more case studies, and then we're going to go ahead and start looking at IT general controls and then application controls. So much more great information coming. Please stay tuned to the series, as I think it'll be very helpful for you to understand the risk and dangers of fraud occurring in America today, and hopefully glean some information to help better safeguard your organizations. Now, before we go, just a reminder, you've just listened to this podcast. You've just watched this on Facebook, YouTube, wherever you happen to get content. You yourself might need some CPE credits. And if that's the case, head on over to cpetoday.com. After watching or listening, take a short 5-question quiz and you will have a credit that you can have to keep your education and keep your license. Today's course code is CSF. Two. Again, today's course code is CSF2, and it'll take you 5 minutes and you'll have your own credit. If you enjoyed our class, please consider reaching us out on social media. You can find us on almost all social medias, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and more, CPE Today. And please consider following us on wherever you happen to get your content. We produce this show live twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays, or at least we try to most weeks. But if you can't watch us live, please consider reaching out and following us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you happen to get content. If you enjoy our content, please leave a review. It helps inform other people and spread the word about our show and hopefully get some more traction. It's always a pleasure being with you. Thank you so much for your time and attention today. Best wishes, and I'll see you back in the office the next time around.